From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Rescue efforts continued in central Italy, where Wednesday's magnitude 6.2 earthquake devastated several towns there. At least 267 people are dead and many remain missing. Today, Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pledged $56 million in funds for rebuilding, a task that the medieval city of L'Aquila is all too familiar with, following the 2009 earthquake that damaged thousands of buildings and killed more than 300 people there. Now, since that 2009 earthquake, Italian officials have cast at least some of the blame on L'Aquila's ancient buildings and poor safety standards, stirring speculation that the same problem may have contributed to this week's disaster. Carmina Galasso is a lecturer in earthquake engineering at the University College London. Carmina, welcome. And first, you've seen the damage in Italy before. What do you make of the damage from this earthquake?
Yeah, so as you probably know, the issue is not really much with new buildings. So Italy has a quite advanced and state-of-the-art building code, not very different from the one that is currently adopted, for example, in the US, in California. The real problem is really with existing old buildings that have been there for several hundred years without any consideration of seismic design code. So based on past experience, so L'Aquila 2009 event, not far away from the current one, is probably 30 miles. It actually was a great wake-up call for Italy for understanding that the key issue is really preparedness. It's not just managing the emergency.
Right. So I want to talk to you about retrofitting and the challenges there in just a moment. But I am curious, at least one reporter from the Washington Post observed that some buildings from, you know, the 1700s may look damaged, but this reporter said it was many of the newer structures that were completely gone. I mean, were they misidentifying the structures?
Well, depends. For example, the recent building code, everything which has been built before 2009 is considered not at current standard. So even what for... can appear as a new building is actually, building codes change each time. Each time there is an event like this one, we learn more, we can get more data. Again, even the current one in the building code of 2009 now will not be considered state-of-the-art anymore in a few years.
Right. Well, so in a place like central Italy, which is known to be very seismically active, and we have these building codes as of 2009 and possibly we'll have even newer ones now, what are the primary challenges for getting many, if not all, of the existing infrastructure up to code?
Yeah, well, of course it's costs. The issue is always who is going to pay for any retrofitting. Is the government that has to pay for it?
Well, would Prime Minister Renzi's $56 million pledge, would it make much of a dent or much of a difference?
Well, again, it's hard to quantify. It requires a lot of investment. And again, also... maybe just homeowners have to contribute to the retrofitting of their own houses. But the problem is, it's until something like the current event happens, people don't really feel how important it is to invest. So, people maybe prefer to invest kind of same amount of money, probably a bit less in doing a new kitchen for their house, but not really for investing in seismic retrofitting of their house. There are good regulations, so it's possible to claim some part of the tax. So I was reading this morning, apparently you can get back about 60% of the cost of the retrofitting, but this takes 10 years, so it's not an immediate payback.
Well, finally, given the considerable cost, as we've discussed, and the complexity of really getting a building up to code when it comes to earthquake protection, does Italy have in place a system to verify whether or not people have actually, made the changes to the building when they claim to have done so? Because, we've been seeing some reports that there have been examples where people have gotten the paperwork saying, yes, we seismically retrofitted our building, but that may not have actually been the case.
Yeah. If people claim that they have done seismic retrofit, somehow, somewhere, they should have basically all the information related to what they have done. And so it's easy to check if this has actually been done. There are other issues that, we cannot control. everything can be perfect on paper, but then I don't know if, again, there are other issues. That...
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we say in the design project, in the design report, we can say that we are using some type of materials. Then there are tests on materials, but they require only, for example, to test a small parts and small number of samples, for example, in terms of materials. And we know that there are uncertainties really at each level from the material, from the load, from the geometry. And the idea of the building code is to be safe enough to try to cover all this uncertainty at our best. But again, there are other causes that we may not be able to control because are outside the control of engineers.
Well, Carmina Galasso is a lecturer in earthquake engineering at University College London, speaking to us about the engineering aspects of the earthquake damage in central Italy. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, as it has in recent years, the Cleveland Orchestra has spent a good part of the summer outside the confines of its usual home, Severance Hall. This summer, it's been performing in the city's Huff neighborhood. Huff is one of Cleveland's poorest areas and the site of a major race riot back in the 1960s. The orchestra's presence there is part of an effort to bring the institution closer to the people. But just dropping in can be tricky. David C. Barnett from Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream explains.
For the past 4 years, the Cleveland Orchestra has taken their act on the road and set up visits around Greater Cleveland. These neighborhood residencies saw various groupings of musicians playing in non-traditional spaces, from ensembles in grocery stores to solo artists in coffee shops. Tanya Boaster says the orchestra's local residencies are part of a major trend happening across the country. She's an associate director of the Oberlin-based Bonner Center for Service and Learning, which works to foster such collaborations.
The old model of service that, you know, I'm going in and doing something to help someone that has a sort of imperial colonial overtones.
That's the concern that Huff Councilman T.J. Dow says he had as the orchestra was planning its residency in his ward. But Dow says the relationship they actually built was refreshing.
That's how you collaborate. You come into a community and you have enough respect for the people that live there and you engage them and you talk with them and then you come up with an event. And so some people get that wrong.
Nationally, arts organizations started exploring ways to interact with their communities about 15 years ago. At the time, the efforts were called outreach, implying a one-way transaction. But the newer term, engagement, suggests a two-way street. Joan Katz-Napoli became familiar with that street this summer. As the orchestra's director of education and community engagement, she was involved in the nuts and bolts of connecting with Huff stakeholders. She says it even took a while to figure out the best way to communicate.
They don't have time to be checking their emails every 20 seconds. And so what we learned was, because Huff is a close-by neighbor, jump in the car and go down and talk to people eyeball to eyeball. It's 5 minutes from Severance Hall. In some respects, a world away, and we want to close that gap.
But how do you know when the gap's closed?
That's really difficult to pin down.
Tanya Boaster says research in this area is new and ongoing as more and more traditional cultural institutions hit the streets and meet the people outside their marble walls.
I think it involves building trust over time. The trust and the relationship building are crucial to doing this well and responsibly.
In this case, the Cleveland Orchestra learns to talk to a potentially new audience, and city residents experience some cultural options they might not have considered before.
That sounds great, so you'll get really good. And that's how Miss Beth got really good, too, by practicing every single day, so it's important to stay.
One of the orchestra's engagement workshops this summer involved violinist Beth Woodside playing some John Philip Sousa for children at the Langston Hughes Branch Library. Educator Rachel Novak taught the kids a little marching dance to the music, which prompted an assortment of smiles and giggles. Afterwards, Tyriana McLean admitted Stars and Stripes Forever wasn't exactly her favorite jam.
I like to listen to Salito, a rapper. Now watch me whip, now watch me nae-nae.
Now watch me whip, whip, watch me nae-nae. Teenage rap star Silento's 2015 summer dance hit Watch Me Whippin' Nae Nae is more Tyrianna's style. But her buddy Jamira Broaddus disagreed, telling Novak that the century-old Sousa song was cool.
100% better than the Whippin' Nae Nae.
Are you serious?
Yes.
That's really nice of you to say. Thank you for saying that. Thanks for coming, guys. Appreciate it.
And the two girls left the classroom with a new song in their heads and a personal connection to an old school institution with something to share just a few blocks away. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Let's take one more trip to Yellowstone Park. Earlier this week, we broadcast the show from Yellowstone to celebrate the Park Service's 100th birthday. On one of those nights, I crossed the Fire Hole River with park rangers Tammy Corchero and Rebecca Rowland. They took me across a bridge with a single flashlight that was no match for the darkness.
Are we going to, like, step off this thing at any point accidentally?
No. We don't want to do that.
Okay.
See, there's railings all the way up.
Now, if the sun were shining, we'd have seen a kaleidoscope of blues and reds and yellows that ring the famous Excelsior Geyser and the Grand Prismatic Spring. But at night, from this vantage point, you couldn't really see anything. You could only hear.
That's the runoff from Excelsior Geyser, pouring out of a geyser crater into the Firehole River.
And the steam is lifting up off the ground and kind of blending in with the Milky Way.
Yes. So we're going to go up a little farther on the boardwalk because it's really cool to see the Milky Way from up top here.
And the Milky Way is why we came. The rangers led me through the rising steam to a spot on the boardwalk where at once the whole galaxy bursts into view. Turns out you can see something in Yellowstone at night. Tammy Corchero is a park ranger whose specialty is stars.
The night sky out here is overwhelming, especially for folks that have never seen a sky like this. It's amazing. It's like we're completely surrounded here by the universe, wouldn't you say?
You can see the Milky Way maybe as clear as I have ever seen the Milky Way before.
Awesome. Well, that's interesting that you say that because about a third of the population of the world can't see the Milky Way anymore. And that includes about 80% of the population of North America. So we now have whole generations of people here in the United States who have never seen the Milky Way. And so that's, one reason why it's so important to protect dark skies like this. It makes me kind of sad to think that there are people that might go through their whole life and never experience something like this. You know, there actually was an astronomer who worked for the U.S. Naval Observatory. His name was Jeff Chester, and he said, "The night sky is the world's largest national park, with its stark beauty available to anyone who steps outside and looks up."
I can see a satellite moving across the sky there. What else do you see?
Sometimes when you sit under a dark sky like this, there's so many stars, and it is really exceptionally clear tonight. There's so many stars that you almost can't even recognize the constellations that you do know.
There's the Big Dipper.
We see the Big Dipper, okay? And the Big Dipper is not actually a constellation. It's...
What?
No. It's an...
You're blowing my mind here. What are you saying the Big Dipper is not
a constellation?
It's
not a constellation. It's actually an asterism. And an asterism is a highly recognizable part of a constellation.
Time out. Stop. What are you doing right now?
So this is a really cool tool that astronomers, and I'm not an astronomer, but I love to share the night sky with people. So I don't know how they did it before this.
You are lightsabering.
Isn't it cool?
Outer space.
I wish that Rebecca had one too.
I love this thing. What is this? What's it called?
It's a laser pointer, and these are.
No, but it's not a normal laser pointer.
It is.
Well, it's a pretty high-powered laser pointer.
Can I just run my finger through it?
Yeah, I think you'll be okay.
Whoa! Oh, my God. Oh, that was so
pretty
weird.
Cool.
There's a giant green light just came off my finger.
You've
no.
Oh, my gosh.
I never have.
We use them at Carlsbad Caverns.
I feel like a small child or something.
Yeah. These are awesome. So they help us to, you know, point out distinct things in the night sky. So, the Big Dipper is a part of the constellation Ursa Major.
Oh, that's right. We were talking about the Big Dipper.
Right. Okay. So the Great Bear, and so the Dipper part of it, that's his body, and then the handle, that's his tail. One really cool thing about the Big Dipper is that it helps us to orient ourselves at night. So if you follow these front two stars here...
Can I see if I remember my middle school astronomy
yes,
class?
Yes, definitely.
If you follow
awesome.
Those front two stars, yep. Is it going to point me to the North Star?
Yes, Polaris, that star right there.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that awesome?
And so you just found that star out of the middle of a sea of stars.
I've been out here a few times. So this star, Polaris, is a relatively stationary star, at least how it appears to us. And the reason why it's stationary is because it lies directly above the Earth's axis of rotation. So if you took a line and you drew it from the South Pole through the center of the Earth, through the North Pole, and extended it out into space, it would eventually intersect with Polaris.
Huh.
Now, an interesting thing about Polaris is that it hasn't always been and it will not always be the North Star, because there's enough wobble in the Earth's rotation on its axis that over time our view of the stars changes. So in about 2,000 years, let me see if I can find it. There's a lot of stars out there tonight. Huh. This star right here, Arai, will become the North Star. So sometime around the year 4100. Okay, here's another cool star. Can you see that red star right there?
Let's see.
So I'm kind of pointing. I'll take the laser pointer.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, I can, but I would never have guessed that that was red unless you told me.
Right. You kind of have to know what you're looking at. That's called the Garnet Star, and it's part of this constellation Cepheus. That's believed to be one of the reddest stars in the sky, and it's also one of the biggest stars in the sky. That's actually a red supergiant star. I'll show you another one here in Scorpius that's, you know, looks more like a supergiant star. That star, let me find it again, right here, is almost 900 million miles in diameter.
And yet it looks like a tiny
It's a tiny dot. You would never find that star if I hadn't pointed it out to you.
I don't know how you did it.
Well, because I know where it is.
Are you lying to me?
No, I'm not making... Well, I could totally make stuff up out here, couldn't I?
Oh my gosh, did you just see that shooting star?
Yeah. No, I was looking over here this way.
So, where we're standing right now, and if the sun were up and it were the middle of the day, there would be hundreds, maybe thousands of people here in the middle of the summer, right?
Oh,
right.
Yes.
Now, we are absolutely by ourselves.
Awesome.
How does the park change for you when the sun goes down?
Well, it provides us, or it provides me, but all of us, access to this whole other half of Yellowstone. And because this park has recognized the value of dark night skies, we are working to protect it. The park does not allow any outdoor lighting outside of develop areas. So no lights on the roads, no lights on the trails, no lights in the backcountry on structures like patrol cabins. And that's to preserve the quality of this wilderness setting that we have here in Yellowstone. And this dark, pristine, amazing sky that we have here tonight is very much a part of that wilderness setting.
Even with those protections, do you feel like the sky is threatened?
Yes. The sky is always threatened because there's you know, there's no guarantee that protections will always be in place. Things change, right? And as I said earlier, you know, a third of the world cannot see the Milky Way anymore. It's actually estimated that light pollution is going to continue to increase at a rate of about 6% per year. And so by the end of this century, no one in the developed world will have dark night skies unless areas are protected. And so right now, one of the things Yellowstone is doing is trying to qualify or get designated as a dark sky park. In 2015, I think there were 19 dark sky parks around the world, state parks, national parks, and other protected areas. One of the qualifications is that 67%, or about two-thirds, of outdoor lights in your park need to be what we call fully shielded, which means the only light that you see is coming down.
It points down. There's a cover on top of it that prevents it from going up.
Prevents it from going up and also prevents it from going out to the sides. We have more than 5,000 outdoor lights in this park. That's a big job to go and inventory all these lights. So we got some help from Oregon Northern University, and they have inventoried a lot of our lights. They've checked the fixtures, the lamps. They've done some nighttime readings. And from what I understand, this is supposed to be completed this next week.
As we speak, I'm seeing another example of light pollution, and it's right over that ridge. The Maple Fire is burning, and you can see it coming up over the mountain in the darkness. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, yes. And that's natural light pollution.
We can live with that.
Yeah, we can. And the moon, you know, you only get stars or skies like this when you don't have the moon out, right? And the moon will come up here in a little while.
Well, Tammy Corchero, we've been speaking for all this time in the darkness. I haven't even seen your face.
Yeah, but look at what you have been seeing. I mean, come on.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to be out here with you tonight.
And sure enough, the moon came out a few minutes later and washed away our view. Beauty is fleeting. Look up while you can. It's here and now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Today, a French court struck down one town's controversial ban on full-body swimsuits designed for Muslim women on the beach. The ruling sets a precedent that threatens similar burkini bans across the country, but at least one French mayor has vowed to fight on. Now, the burkini ban really blew up on social media this week after a photograph of police apparently forcing a woman to disrobe on the beach in Nice went viral. For more, we're joined by Femi Oke from Al Jazeera English. Nice to talk to you again, Femi.
It's nice to talk to you too. This is a big story this week.
It is.
Do you know how I know?
How?
Just in terms of social media, how many people are talking about this? My team looked at #bikini ban, 300,000 tweets across the globe in less than 48 hours. That's how big this story is, how big it's resonating online.
Wow. So do you think that the social media response to it in part, I mean, we can't know, but is that part of the pressure that led France's top administrative court to overturn the ban?
This story blew up, not just in France, but around the world. I can't get into the mind of the High Court in France, but certainly they knew as they were making this decision how big it would be, what the implications would be for France and internationally as well.
So talk to us about some of the ways that people have been using social media to talk about the burkini.
You get a look into the mind of what's happening in France by just looking at the conversation online. Sometimes you think 140 characters in a tweet, how can that convey a debate? Let me give you one example here from David S. The burqa and bikini are passive-aggressive symbols of Islamic female oppression. I'm not going to just let that sit there. Hindmaki says, I generally don't believe Bikini Ban is about France liberating women. It's about the inability to view Muslim citizens as equals. And so the debate goes back and forth. What you hear is fear from within France, a fear of Muslim women, fear of overt signs of Islam, but also indignation from women about how dare you tell us what we wear, how dare you police our bodies, and not just from Muslim communities within France and Muslim communities around the world, but actually it's very difficult to see pictures of a woman being undressed on a beach in Nice and to remain neutral about what that picture means and signify. And I think that's why this is such a big conversation in social media.
Right. I mean, I've been seeing people tweet things to the like of, you know, how is forcing women not to wear a particular outfit any different than forcing them to wear a particular outfit? We've also seen people posting pictures of nuns in their complete habits, for example, on the beach.
It's very visual. So nuns on the beach and their habits, paddling, acidic Jews also sunbathing, but fully covered up, their hair covered, their bodies mostly covered, and just their toes sort of out there on the sand. There was one picture that really resonates, and this is a picture going back to when bathing suits were first all of the rage, and policemen on the beach measuring the length of a bathing suit. And then that picture was juxtaposed with the picture of a woman this week who was on the beach in Nice. If you think about how this story resonates, people around the world were protesting. There's a new hashtag now, not just bikini ban and bikini, but wear what we want. So this goes beyond France and its cultural issues, but also talking about, is it okay for men to tell women what they should wear? That's the bigger question.
Femi Okeh with Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
The University of Chicago is taking a stand against trigger warnings and safe spaces. The school sent a letter to incoming freshmen saying the university does not support giving advanced warning when professors tackle sensitive topics. It also does not condone safe places where students can go to avoid opinions they disagree with. And it will not cancel speakers who've been invited to talk about controversial topics. Jeffrey Stone is a law professor at the University of Chicago. He was lead author of its 2015 report on freedom of expression that laid the foundation for this week's letter to students. Jeffrey Stone, welcome.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So first of all, why no trigger warnings and why no safe spaces?
Well, the basic principle on which the University of Chicago was founded is a deep commitment to academic freedom and to the freedom of expression. And the core notion is that the way we seek the truth, the way we learn, the way we educate ourselves and one another is by a full and complete freedom to put forth ideas, to disagree with ideas, to argue with them, to condemn them, to defend them, and to work out for ourselves what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. And there's been a trend in recent years in colleges and universities to put barriers in the way of that academic freedom. And Chicago has long stood for as full and complete an academic freedom as possible. And this is reflected in the statement that the committee wrote a year and a half ago and in the Dean of Students statement that was sent to entering freshmen the other day.
Well, the trend, as you call it, reached a fever pitch last fall. You probably remember, I know a lot of people do, at Yale when a professor defended her students' rights to choose their own Halloween costumes after the school had sent out a letter with a list of guidelines on how not to offend people with Halloween costumes. She suggested, the professor, that students could simply just talk to the person that they found offensive, but she was excoriated by students, and so was her husband, a residence director and a professor himself. Here's what that interaction sounded like.
No, I don't agree with that.
Then why the f*** did you accept the position?
Because
who hired you?
I have a different vision.
You should step down. If that is what you think about being a professor, you should step down. It is not about creating an intellectual space. It is not. Do you understand that? It's about creating a home here.
Jeffrey Stone, how did we get to that place in the United States?
Well, I think a couple of things have happened in recent years. One explanation, which has been put forth by a number of people, is that this new generation of college students has been raised by so-called helicopter parents, that they have been shielded and protected and celebrated from the time of their birth and have basically been immunized from having to deal with frustration and defeat and challenge, and that when encountering it, they don't have the resilience that their predecessors had and therefore seek protection from those things that they find upsetting. And to the extent that's true, it seems to me that a core responsibility of colleges and universities is to enable those students to develop the mechanisms that effective citizens need to have in order to deal in the real world with ideas and views that they find loathsome and offensive, and not to shield them in the way their parents allegedly have. The second factor is a more positive one, and that's that I think it's probably true that educators, including myself, became somewhat oblivious to the fact that there were students from a wide range of different groups in our communities who were feeling marginalized and devalued and were harmed in meaningful ways by some discourse that most of the rest of us regarded as innocuous. And to the credit of this generation of students, they have been in some ways courageous in being willing to say, this is intolerable. This is not acceptable. This has a harm.
I want to ask you about that. I want to defend college students here for just a moment, because if I compare them to the college students of my day and probably the generation before that, this generation of students, I feel like, is far more conscious of racism in society, far more conscious of things like homophobia in our society. You know, what's wrong with creating a space, a safe space, for instance, where those things aren't encouraged? I mean, aren't they doing the right thing in a way?
The right thing is to condemn those who make racist or sexist or homophobic statements. It's to explain why that's loathsome and why that's odious. It's not to try to shut down the free speech.
Well, there is a Cornell professor who makes the argument that trigger warnings are used in her class, and that she doesn't use them because she wants students to avoid the material, but instead she uses them to prepare the students for difficult content so they have time to process it and then to have a conversation about an issue. And this is particularly important if some of the kids in her class have been exposed to violence or abuse. I mean, what do you say to that professor's argument that trigger warnings have a place in academics?
I think it's within the academic freedom of each individual faculty member to decide for him or herself what's the best way to teach a class. And nothing at Chicago prohibits a faculty member from deciding that he or she thinks this is the best way to deal with certain material. The point is, the university will not require faculty members to do this.
And what's the student reaction been so far?
The student reaction in general to the university policy has been extraordinarily enthusiastic. There have been some students, certainly, and an op-ed in the student newspaper, The Maroon, that said we should be banning hate speech and so on. But the overall reaction, I think, from faculty, students, and alumni has been very positive. Chicago has long defined itself as an institution that is deeply committed to academic freedom and free expression. People who come here know that. They take pride in that. And frankly, people who I think are intimidated by that sensibly choose to go somewhere else.
It almost seems like a ridiculous question to ask you, but I'm going to do it because this is the conversations we're having on college campuses across the country. Let's say this fall someone wears an offensive costume on Halloween, a blackface, for instance. How do you recommend your students deal with that?
I suggest that if they think it's offensive and inappropriate and loathsome, that they should condemn it. And they should make clear this person's a jerk, or worse. But I don't think the university should punish the student.
Jeffrey Stone is a law professor at the University of Chicago, and he was lead author of the school's report on the freedom of expression. Professor Stone, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And one more note on this story. A former student body president at the University of Chicago is responding to the letter. Tyler Kissinger says during his tenure as president, he was threatened with expulsion for helping to organize a campus sit-in. He said on Twitter that the school's stand against trigger warnings and safe spaces is a public relations move for a university that has a long history of refusing to submit itself to the same sort of critical inquiry it champions. Also, in higher ed today, state lawmakers in Virginia want to know why the state's flagship public university is raising tuition while it's sitting on a pile of cash. The University of Virginia is facing criticism for hiking tuition 30% over the last few years, while at the same time setting aside more than $2 billion of taxpayer money into an investment fund. Today, lawmakers will question school officials about the fund and what they plan to do with it. Democratic State Senator Scott Surivel of Fairfax told us today that the fund concerns him in several ways.
I'm a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law. My wife got her undergraduate degree from UVA. My father went to UVA Law. My mother went to graduate school there. My uncle went to undergraduate there. So my family has benefited a lot from a UVA education through the years. And you know, I'm concerned both as an alumni of the school, as a state senator, as a father of a prospective student, and as a taxpayer.
This year, for instance, an incoming in-state freshman will pay $13,000 in tuition. 3 years ago, it was $10,000. Surivel says he doesn't think it's right for a public school to sit on a huge amount of cash while raising tuition.
UVA is the crown jewel of the Virginia higher educational system. We all recognize that. But they've also been admitting more and more and more out-of-state students over the last 10 years to the exclusion of in-state Virginia students. And they claim they've been doing it because they need the money. But what we now know is that if they've been running, you know, $50 or $100 million surpluses for the last 10 years, it had nothing to do with the money.
And we reached out to the university. It shared a statement with us from President Teresa Sullivan, who said the university must commit itself to excellence and quality to remain one of the nation's top universities, and that the investment fund promotes programs that fulfill that commitment.
On Sunday, HBO closes out what NPR TV critic Eric Deggans calls one of this year's best series. It's called The Night Of. The crime drama begins when Nasir Khan, or Nas, played by Riz Ahmed, spends a night partying with a young woman. He wakes up to find her murdered, and he's arrested soon after. We've got a clip.
I didn't do it.
Didn't do what? What's your name, son?
Nasir, you don't understand.
That's why we're going to talk, okay? So I will understand. Just you and me. Come over here. Come on.
Let go.
Come on.
On the ground.
Well, Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
All right. So first of all, tell us what the premise of this show is. I mean, it's about a murder, but it's more than that.
Much, much more than that. So in the first episode, we meet this rather sheltered, rather innocent son of Pakistani immigrants who borrows his dad's taxi to try and go to a party. He winds up picking up this mysterious woman. They end up doing drugs and getting drunk and having sex. And then when he wakes up, she's been murdered. And what we see is someone who doesn't have a lot of resources, who is a son of immigrants, who's a Muslim, who is accused of a horrific crime against a beautiful white girl. And all of the machinery that kicks into place. We see the criminal justice bureaucracy. We see how the media treats him. We see how his family is impoverished by trying to come up with money, both for his defense, and also they see their employment affected by the public condemnation of the crime. And he has to learn how to survive in Rikers Island, which is this brutal prison in New York where people often wait years to go to trial. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, it's a treatise on all those things all at once.
So there's so much going on here, including some great performances as well. And I want to listen to a clip from The Night Of. And here you're going to hear the character John Stone, played by John Turturro. He's the attorney representing the young Pakistani-American who's been accused of the murder. Let's listen.
They come up with their story. We come up with ours. The jury gets to decide which they like best. Now, the good news is we get to hear what their story is first before we have to tell them ours. So we keep our mouths shut until we know what they're doing.
You keep saying story like I'm making it up. I want to tell you the truth.
You really, really don't. I don't want to be stuck with the truth. Not until I have to be.
Eric, tell us what the relationship between these two main characters says.
I just love that New York accent. You know, I don't want to be stuck with the truth until I have to be. What's great about this show is that it tries to give you a more realistic picture of the criminal justice system. And this character is wonderful. He's an ambulance chasing, you know, sort of working class lawyer. You know, he's getting $250 a pop. And then finally, he lands on this kid who he can tell is kind of innocent. Looking, and he thinks that he's just been accused of a much more minor crime, like an assault or something, and then he finds out that he's accused of this murder that is garnering all kinds of headlines, and it could be a career-making case for him. But he uses his street smarts and he uses his sort of empathy to try and do the best he can for a client that most of the world has kind of written off. And it just shows, you know, what the legal system is really like. A lot of times trials don't necessarily get to the truth of an issue. They just sort of expose which side has told the best story or which side has convinced a jury, you know, more convincingly.
Mm-hmm. You know, I read one review that said great shows make their own luck. And here, The Night Of seems to be full of that kind of luck, because not only is the nation going through this, you know, giant reexamination of the criminal justice system, but also the main character is a young Pakistani American whose last name happens to be Khan, right? So, I mean, it's not like they couldn't foresee sort of how the reality of life for Muslim Americans would be playing out in this current presidential election. But let's talk about the main character and how he and his family are portrayed in the series.
Well, yeah, it's sort of amazing. I mean, the series was developed by Steven Zaillian, who is the screenwriter of Schindler's List, among many other great film projects. And he spent 7 years developing this from a British TV series. So there's no way they could have really anticipated how prescient or how on the nose, you know, all these issues that they're wrestling with would turn out to be when the show debuted. So some of it is luck. But some of it is the fact that they're talking about things that we've been wrestling with for a while. I mean, we've been trying to figure out how we feel about immigrants in this country since 9/11. We've been trying to figure out how we feel about policing and how people of color are policed, you know, since Trayvon Martin was killed in 2012 and even before that. But, you know, it really became a huge mainstream media issue then. So these are issues we've been tussling with for a long time.
Well, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking about The Night Of, the HBO series whose final episode airs on Sunday. Eric, thanks as always.
And I'm a critic. I haven't even seen that episode. I can't wait on to be eating my popcorn with everybody else.
Well, Meghna, it is that time of year, late summer, I am sad to admit it, when our summer interns become students again. Today, a hearty thank you to Greta Yoakum, a budding journalist who has been a huge help here with our website. Greta's going back to Tufts University. Greta, best of luck to you and the future of journalism right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin and Jeremy are back on Monday. This is Here and Now.